The political landscape, much like the human mind, is a swirling tapestry woven from countless individual threads. Each thread represents a belief, an attitude, a deeply held value. The collective strength and direction of these threads, the grand pattern they form, is what we call public opinion. But how do these individual threads come into being? How are they dyed with particular hues, shaped by various forces, and ultimately, how do we, as observers, even begin to discern the overall design? This is the fascinating realm of public opinion and political socialization, a field that seeks to unravel the mysteries of how societies think about politics and why. For centuries, philosophers and rulers have pondered the general will or the voice of the people. Ancient Greek city-states relied on assemblies where citizens could directly voice their opinions, while Enlightenment thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau conceptualized a collective desire that should guide governments. Yet, for much of history, understanding this collective voice was more art than science. It relied on observing crowds, listening to gossip, or perhaps consulting local notables. It was only in the 20th century that systematic, quantitative methods emerged, transforming the study of public opinion from philosophical speculation into an empirical discipline. At its core, public opinion is not a singular, unified entity. Rather, it is a complex mosaic, an aggregation of the individual attitudes and beliefs that a significant portion of the population holds concerning political issues, policies, leaders, and events. Think of it as a vast, ever-shifting ocean, with currents and tides representing broad trends and countless individual waves, each reflecting a particular viewpoint. This ocean is dynamic. A calm surface can quickly become turbulent in the face of a major event, and long-term currents can subtly alter its character over decades. It is multifaceted, encompassing everything from a strong conviction about a particular environmental regulation to a general feeling of approval or disapproval for the current head of state. Its character is shaped by a myriad of forces, from deeply personal experiences to the broad sweep of historical events, from the whispers of family conversations to the thunder of mass media. And crucially, public opinion is rarely held with uniform intensity. Some issues ignite passionate debate, while others elicit only a shrug. The modern quest to understand this intricate ocean often begins with an attempt to measure it. How do we quantify something as elusive as collective thought? The answer, in the contemporary political landscape, overwhelmingly points to public opinion polls or surveys. While these tools appear simple on the surface, merely asking people questions, their scientific rigor, or lack thereof, can dramatically affect the accuracy of the picture they paint. The bedrock of any credible public opinion poll is sampling. Imagine trying to gauge the average salinity of our vast ocean. You wouldn't drink the entire ocean, nor would you just taste the water near the shore. Instead, you take numerous small samples from various depths and locations, trusting that these samples, if collected correctly, would give you a reliable estimate of the whole. In polling, this principle is embodied by random sampling. This technique is designed to ensure that every single individual in the target population, whether that's all eligible voters in a country or all residents of a particular city, has an equal, non-zero chance of being selected for the survey. This equal chance is not merely an ideal, it is a statistical necessity for the poll's results to be generalizable, meaning they can be reliably extrapolated to represent the broader population. Without random sampling, the poll risks capturing only the views of a specific, non-representative slice of the population, leading to skewed and misleading conclusions. The size of this sample also matters. Intuitively, one might assume that more people always mean better results. And to a certain extent, that's true. A larger sample generally reduces the margin of error, making the poll's estimate closer to the true population value. However, there are diminishing returns. Moving from a sample of 100 to 1,000 dramatically improves accuracy, but moving from 1,500 to 10,000 offers only marginal additional precision, often at a significantly increased cost. For national polls in countries like the United States, a sample size of 1,000 to 1,500 individuals is often considered sufficient to achieve a respectable margin of error, typically around plus or minus 3 percentage points. This margin of error is a critical piece of information. If a poll reports that 50% of people support a candidate with a margin of error of +/-3%, it means the pollsters are 95% confident that the actual level of support in the entire population lies somewhere between 47% and 53%. Ignoring this margin can lead to misinterpretations, especially when candidates are locked in tight races. Beyond who is asked, what is asked and how it is asked are equally vital. The wording of questions is an art form unto itself. A poorly worded question can inadvertently lead respondents to a particular answer, injecting bias into the results. Neutral language is paramount. Emotionally charged terms or phrases that suggest a correct answer can corrupt the data. Consider the difference between "Do you support the government's proposal to reform healthcare?" and "Do you support the government's reckless plan to dismantle affordable healthcare?" The latter, clearly loaded, would likely elicit a very different response. The order in which questions are presented can also subtly influence opinions. An initial question about a popular political figure might put respondents in a more positive frame of mind for subsequent questions about that figure's policies, regardless of their actual feelings on those policies. Clarity and simplicity are also essential. Jargon, double negatives, or overly complex sentences can confuse respondents, leading to unreliable answers or even outright refusals to participate. Pollsters also grapple with the choice between open-ended questions, which allow respondents to articulate their thoughts freely and offer rich, nuanced qualitative data, and closed-ended questions like multiple choice or agreement scales, which are easier to quantify and analyze statistically but might force complex opinions into overly simplistic categories. The methods of interviewing have evolved dramatically over time. Historically, face-to-face interviews offered a direct, personal connection, but were expensive and time-consuming. Telephone polling, especially with the advent of random digit dialing, became a dominant method, offering a balance of speed and cost-effectiveness. However, declining response rates, the prevalence of caller ID, and the rise of mobile-only households have complicated phone polling. Today, online surveys, often utilizing carefully managed panels of respondents, have become increasingly common, alongside mixed-mode approaches that combine various techniques. Each method has its own set of trade-offs regarding cost, speed, demographic reach, and potential for bias. Even the interviewer's presence can be a subtle source of bias. A respondent might be hesitant to express an unpopular opinion to a live person, a phenomenon known as interviewer effects. Once the data is collected, a sophisticated process of analysis and interpretation begins. Pollsters use various statistical techniques to make sense of the raw numbers, identifying trends, correlations, and drawing conclusions about public sentiment. A crucial step here is weighting. It's rare for any random sample to perfectly mirror the demographic composition of the larger population. For instance, a phone poll might inadvertently oversample older individuals who are more likely to answer landlines, or an online poll might undersample those without internet access. To correct for these imbalances, pollsters apply statistical weights, adjusting the data so that the sample's demographics, for example age, gender, race, education, geographic location, align with known population benchmarks. This ensures that the voices of underrepresented groups are not drowned out, and those of overrepresented groups are not amplified disproportionately. Despite these sophisticated methodologies, the measurement of public opinion is fraught with challenges and criticisms. One significant issue is non-response bias. The people who choose to participate in polls may systematically differ from those who refuse. If, for example, highly engaged citizens are more likely to answer surveys, their views might be overrepresented compared to less engaged segments of the population. Another persistent concern is the social desirability bias, where respondents might not give their true opinion, but rather an answer they perceive as socially acceptable or politically correct. This is particularly relevant on sensitive topics like racial attitudes or support for controversial candidates. This phenomenon was famously, though not universally, referred to as the Bradley effect or Wilder effect, suggesting that some voters might tell pollsters they support a minority candidate, only to vote for a white candidate in the privacy of the voting booth. While the extent and persistence of this effect are debated, it highlights the potential disconnect between stated opinions and actual behavior. Furthermore, polls often reveal that many individuals hold non-attitudes. They might offer an opinion on an issue they know little about, simply to be polite or avoid admitting ignorance. This can make public opinion appear more coherent and informed than it truly is. There's also the common criticism that media coverage of polls often focuses disproportionately on horse race aspects, who's ahead, who's gaining, rather than delving into the nuances of public opinion on substantive policy issues. This can reduce elections to mere contests of popularity rather than debates over competing visions for the future. Despite these challenges, public opinion polls play an indispensable role in democratic societies. They lend legitimacy to governance. When government policies align with the public's wishes, it reinforces the notion that the government is responsive to its citizens, fostering trust and stability. Policymakers frequently consult public opinion data, using it as one input among many when crafting legislation. While they aren't always bound by it, leaders may choose to lead public opinion, follow it, or occasionally ignore it. It certainly acts as a significant gravitational force. Public opinion also serves as a crucial mechanism for accountability, as elected officials, keen on re-election, are generally attentive to shifts in public sentiment. Finally, significant movements in public opinion can act as an early warning system, signaling societal discontent or a collective desire for change, prompting political leaders to address emerging issues before they escalate. It is important to remember, however, that public opinion is only one factor among many that shape policy. Elite opinions, the persistent lobbying of interest groups, economic conditions, and the ideological commitments of politicians also wield considerable influence. But where do these individual beliefs, which aggregate into public opinion, originate? This is the domain of political socialization, the profound and lifelong process through which individuals acquire their political beliefs, attitudes, values, and norms. It is the journey through which we learn to navigate the political world, understanding its rules, identifying with its actors, and developing our own unique place within it. While it is a continuous process, the foundational years of childhood and adolescence are often the most impactful, shaping our fundamental political identity. The agents of political socialization are the various sources from which we absorb these political lessons. The family is, arguably, the most primary and powerful agent, especially in early childhood. Long before children encounter formal political education, they are exposed to the political world through their parents. They might hear political discussions at the dinner table, observe their parents watching news or voting, or simply absorb the general political leaning or party identification of their household. It's often an indirect learning process, subtle yet pervasive, influencing a child's initial understanding of authority, fairness, and community. While familial influence is strong, it's not immutable. As individuals mature and encounter other influences, their specific policy views may diverge from their parents, even if a general political orientation persists. As children grow, schools become increasingly significant. Beyond the explicit curriculum of civics classes, history lessons, and government structures, schools convey a hidden curriculum. This includes learning about rules and authority figures, participating in group decision-making, and being exposed to patriotic symbols or rituals like the Pledge of Allegiance. Schools aim to cultivate informed and responsible citizens, imparting democratic ideals and fostering a sense of civic duty. They provide the initial framework for understanding complex political concepts and the machinery of government. During adolescence, peer groups, friends, classmates, social circles begin to exert a powerful influence. As individuals seek autonomy from their families and define their own identities, the opinions of their peers become highly salient. Discussions and debates within these groups can reinforce existing beliefs or introduce entirely new perspectives. The desire to conform or fit in can also lead individuals to adopt the political attitudes prevalent within their peer group. though this influence is often more about social identity than deep ideological conversion. The mass media, in all its forms, television, radio, newspapers, and increasingly, the internet and social media, acts as a colossal information conduit, shaping perceptions of political events, candidates, and policies. The media not only informs but also influences what issues the public considers important agenda setting and how those issues are presented framing. For example, the media might frame a debate about climate change as an economic challenge or as a moral imperative, each framing eliciting different public responses. The rise of social media has introduced new complexities, from the rapid dissemination of news and misinformation to the creation of echo chambers where individuals are primarily exposed to viewpoints that confirm their existing biases. It also allows for unprecedented direct engagement between citizens and political figures, bypassing traditional media gatekeepers. Religious institutions also play a significant role for many, providing a moral and ethical framework that often extends to political views. This is particularly evident in debates over social issues like abortion, LGBTQ+ rights, or even foreign policy, where deeply held religious convictions can translate directly into political stances. Religious leaders and communities can also influence congregants' political participation and voting behavior, either through explicit endorsements or through the broader values they instill. Finally, major life events and personal experiences can profoundly reshape an individual's political outlook. Think of the lasting imprint that the Great Depression left on an entire generation, or how the Vietnam War fueled anti-war sentiment among young people. These generational effects mean that cohorts of individuals who come of age during similar periods tend to share certain political experiences and views that differentiate them from older or younger generations. On a more personal level, experiences with unemployment, discrimination, military service, becoming a parent, or navigating complex healthcare systems can all profoundly shift an individual's political priorities and beliefs. These personal narratives intertwine to form the larger story of a generation's political identity. Various models attempt to explain the intricate journey of political socialization. The developmental model suggests that political attitudes evolve in stages, from a basic awareness of authority figures in childhood to more sophisticated and abstract understandings of political systems in adulthood. The life cycle model posits that political attitudes shift as individuals progress through different stages of life. Young adulthood, middle age, retirement, often reflecting changing priorities and responsibilities. And the generational model, as discussed, emphasizes the enduring impact of shared historical events on specific cohorts, shaping their distinctive political characteristics. Ultimately, political socialization is the foundational process that builds the individual beliefs and attitudes which, when aggregated, coalesce into public opinion. Understanding how individuals are socialized helps us comprehend why certain demographic groups tend to hold particular views, how stable or volatile public opinion might be at any given moment, and how political cultures are either sustained or transformed over time. If a particular community consistently socializes its children into a specific political ideology, this will inevitably contribute to persistent regional patterns in public opinion and electoral outcomes. Similarly, a generation that experiences prolonged economic hardship might develop a collective opinion on the role of government in the economy that is vastly different from a generation that grew up in prosperity. Yet, this field is far from settled, marked by vigorous debates and contested aspects. Scholars grapple with the question of the rationality of public opinion. Are citizens genuinely informed and capable of forming coherent political judgments, or are their views easily swayed by elites and media manipulation? Some, like Philip Converse, have argued that much of the public holds non-attitudes, offering superficial responses rather than deeply held convictions. Others contend that even if detailed knowledge is lacking, individuals often use heuristics, mental shortcuts, to make reasonable political decisions. The impact of social media is a particularly hot topic, with researchers debating its role in fostering polarization, spreading misinformation, or conversely, facilitating genuine civic engagement. The consistent decline in public trust in governmental institutions and traditional media outlets is another pressing concern, prompting extensive research into its causes and consequences for democratic health. Furthermore, ongoing culture wars and shifts in societal values raise questions about how socialization might perpetuate or mitigate these divisions. And in the realm of polling, declining response rates for traditional methods necessitate constant innovation, with researchers exploring the potential of online panels and other data sources to maintain accuracy and representativeness. These ongoing debates and evolving methodologies underscore the dynamic and complex nature of public opinion and political socialization. They are not merely academic curiosities but fundamental pillars of political science, essential for understanding the heartbeat of democracies, the pulse of collective sentiment, and the very foundations upon which political systems are built and sustained.